We turn to our study of the book of Daniel this evening. We'll be looking at Daniel chapter 2. Let me introduce our study this way. I think most everyone would like to know the future. That was certainly true in ancient days. Foretelling the future was one of the main preoccupations of the priests and prophets of ancient civilization. Many methods were used for foreseeing the future. One was hepatoscopy. I've been practicing all week to say that. Hepatoscopy. With this method, the diviner would kill an animal, such as a goat. He would cut the goat open there at the altar, and what he would do is he would examine the arrangement of the animal's liver. Hepatitis is a disease that attacks the liver, so you knew where we were going, to the liver, hepatoscopy. What he would do is he would examine the animal's liver, the most prominent of internal organs. Based on the position and based on the surface of the liver, the priest or the diviner would then expound the will of the gods. In fact, archaeologists have unearthed the manuals used for the training of those priests. They have found liver-shaped clay tablets covered with instructions detailing which appearances of the liver signified what. Hepatoscopy was quite popular in ancient days. Nebuchadnezzar himself, for example, used it. Ezekiel 21, verse 21, records how Nebuchadnezzar decided Jerusalem would be his next target during the invasion of Judah. That verse said this, "For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the ways, at the head of two ways, to use divination. He shakes the arrows, he consults the household idols, and he looks at the liver." Now, besides liver gazing, Ezekiel 21:21 mentioned two other methods that people of ancient days used to see the future. To decide which road the gods wanted to take, you could throw some arrows up into the air and see which direction they pointed when they landed. You could consult your idols and see if the god would give you a dream or a vision. And there were many methods of divination. Some consulted the dead, others used incubation. That was sleeping in a sacred place, hoping that the gods would give you a message when you did that. Of course, you were more likely to get a message if you smoked some weird kind of mushroom before you went and slept there, but that was beside the point. Now, astrology was also important. As you know, most ancient peoples believed that heavenly bodies, stars, and planets influenced or dictated the future of people and nations. A little has changed today. Even if liver gazing has fallen out of popularity somewhat, foretelling the future is still big business. Astrology, for example, has survived in our culture and horoscopes and all of that. In the black culture, witch doctors still do their rituals to determine what the future holds. Investment firms pay millions a year for a market analyst who seems to be able to predict what the financial markets will do next week. Judging by their success, maybe they should go back to reading livers. People want to know the future. It's always been true. That's why worry is such a predominant sin in our lives. Now, in the Bible, though, God rejected all forms of trying to know or control the future. Why? Only He can do that. Let me read for you for a moment from Isaiah chapter 47. There Isaiah mocked the ability of the diviners, the astrologists, and the magicians to see the future. Just listen. Isaiah 47:12. "Stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, let them stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Behold, they have become like stubble, and fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame." Isaiah wrote those words 80 to 100 years before Daniel and his friends were taken to Babylon. Therefore, Daniel and his friends, through the mockery of the prophet Isaiah, they knew that the incantations, spells, divinings, and dream interpretations of the Babylonian magicians and wise men were just so much rubbish. And therefore, although they had to learn the literature of the Chaldeans, they rejected completely their esoteric mystical methods of foretelling the future. The verses I read to you in Isaiah 47 were about the land of Babylon. And so Daniel and his friends would have known those verses and knew they needed to reject all of that. They rejected all those mystical sort of methods of foretelling the future, and they trusted their God. That comes through loud and clear in Daniel chapter 2, our text for this evening. Daniel 2. I've called this chapter World History 101. World History 101. That's because this is Daniel's most basic prophecy. By the time you get to the end of the book, he's going to get a little more technical and a lot more detail. But chapter 2 is just a first-year class. It prepares you for what's to come. It's an introduction, really. Its message is powerful nonetheless. Only God knows and controls the future. Now, you can see as we come to this chapter that a man wondering about the future is the context of the whole chapter. Look at Daniel 2:29. Daniel is speaking to Nebuchadnezzar here, and he says, "As for you, O king, while you were on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future." So although the king of the mighty Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar was haunted by the same fears and worries of lesser men. And God wanted to teach Nebuchadnezzar a great lesson about who really knows and controls the future. And so God gave him a dream. And that is the message of, or the flow of the whole chapter, wrapped around this dream and its interpretation. Chapter 2, verse 1. "Now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him." And I'll give you an outline as we go along this evening for each section. We can call verse 1 insomnia. Insomnia. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, or literally several dreams, one night while laying on his bed. Now, since the Babylonian system didn't count part of Nebuchadnezzar's first year on the throne, this was both Nebuchadnezzar's second year on the throne and the third year, or the end of the third year, of Daniel's training. The king would always, reign would always be 1 year behind the end of Daniel's training because of the way they counted the first year. And so verse 1 says, "This is the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar, but Daniel's training has ended," as chapter 1 has already told us. "He was troubled in his spirit," was Nebuchadnezzar, "when he had these dreams, and his sleep left him. Now, so great was the impression made on Nebuchadnezzar by this dream that he couldn't get back to sleep. This dream, he knew, was more than merely his mind on holiday for the night. This, he believed, was a message from the gods. Now, as with all kings in the ancient Near East, Nebuchadnezzar had a special class of servants that he fed and housed for the sole purpose of explaining to him what the gods were saying, what was going to happen in the future. And so as soon as morning came, Nebuchadnezzar called those diviners and priests to the throne room. It's time for them to earn their salary. Verse 2, "Then the king gave orders to call the magicians and the conjurers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, 'I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream.'" Now this section, verses 2 through 11, we will call incompetence. Incompetence. It is Isaiah 47 come to life. It is the incompetence of the conjurers, sorcerers, and magicians. Verse 3. "The king said to them, 'I had a dream. My spirit is anxious to understand the dream.'" Like many immensely successful men, Nebuchadnezzar lived in terror of the day that his glory might fade. He was desperate to discover whether the dream that he had been given boded good or ill for his future. And so he called in the experts. They had the calm, confident attitudes of proven professionals. Verse 4. "Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic." This is the point where the Hebrew of this book shuts off, and it turns into Aramaic till the end of chapter 7. "They spoke to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever. Sort of nonsense he had to say to the king. Tell the dream to your servants and we'll declare the interpretation. Pretty confident guys. They're professionals. Give us the dream, O king, and we'll be glad to give you the interpretation. Now, their confidence was understandable. Through the centuries, great instruction manuals for interpreting dreams have been written by their predecessors. Archaeologists have, in fact, discovered a number of these. Every time someone had what seemed to be a significant dream, the scholars recorded what happened to that person afterwards. And then supposed correlations between the dream and what happened to the person were recorded and analyzed. These men felt sure that their exhaustive dream manuals would give them the interpretation of the king's dream. Say, tell us what you saw, king. We'll go back and research what happened to someone else in the past when they had a similar dream, and we'll tell you what's going to happen to you. Nebuchadnezzar, however, didn't want a standardized textbook kind of answer. He wanted some proof that these guys actually had access to a higher knowledge, not just a bunch of books in a library. Verse 5. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap." Now, there are two ways to translate the opening sentence of verse 5. The issue of the two translations is whether or not Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the dream. Did he forget it or not? You see, did you notice that his command to the wise men and the magicians was not just to tell him the interpretation? He wanted them to tell him He wanted them to tell him the dream itself. He said, "You have to interpret the dream, but you got to tell me the dream too." Verse 5. King answered, said to the Chaldeans, "Command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation." That's what he's asking from them. And this is pretty significant stuff, right? And if he gives them the dream, they'll just trot off to their library, manufacture some sort of interpretation, and come back. But now he expects them to prove that they actually do have higher knowledge. He says, "You have to give me the dream as well." And so the question is, had Nebuchadnezzar forgotten the dream? I don't think so, and here's why. If Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the dream, then why didn't the magicians save their lives, which they're going to lose if they don't, do something quick, why wouldn't they save their lives by just making up a dream? These guys aren't total idiots, right? Why not just make one up? If the king had forgotten his dream, how would he know the difference, right? And if the king really remembered his dream and was just testing you, well, you were going to die anyway, so you might as well at least give it a shot. Make one up! But they didn't do that. Why? Because I think Nebuchadnezzar did remember the dream. He did remember. They couldn't just make one up. He wanted to test these guys to see if they were for real. Anyone could wing an interpretation with a little pseudo-prophetic mumbo-jumbo. Psychologists do it all the time today. But to recount the dream without being told what it was, that would take special knowledge and would then validate the interpretation as well, right? And therefore, I would read what the New American Standard has. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. The word from me is firm. It's gone out from me. I've told you what I want. If you don't make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you're going to be torn limb from limb. And your houses will be made a rubbish heap." You can see the punishment is pretty gruesome if these guys fail. It's not like positive encouragement here. "We'll rip your arms and your legs off one at a time," says Nebuchadnezzar, "and we're going to turn your house into the city sewer." Now, if they succeeded, though, the reward would be correspondingly glamorous. Verse 6. "But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward of great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation." Now, you might wonder why Nebuchadnezzar would put his key counselors to this kind of impossible test. It may be that as a young king, he was constantly clashing with these older advisors who had probably served his father. This was a good way for them either to prove their worth or be permanently removed. As one commentator said, Nebuchadnezzar might well have doubted their honesty, sincerity, and capability. I think that's certainly true. But whatever his reason, Nebuchadnezzar made this test a do-or-die endeavor. Now, the wise man remained unruffled. They could face down this young upstart of a king. Verse 7. And they answered a second time and said, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation. Tell us the dream, king. We'll give you the interpretation. That's the rules of the game. Don't you get it, Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar is not going to allow himself to be bullied, though. Verse 8, the king answered and said, I know for certain you're bargaining for time. You guys are stalling. You're bargaining for time, and as much as you've seen from me, the command is firm. That if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's not going to be pushed around. This pack of liver gazers is starting to get a little bit worried at this point, verse 10. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on the earth who could declare the matter for the king. Inasmuch as no great king, I mean, king, you're asking the impossible. There's no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, yeah, to put it mildly, and there is no one else who can declare it to the king except gods. They had one too many letters in that word, right? That's how they understood it. No one can declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Now, what this basically is an admission of incompetence on the part of these supposed wise men. Only the gods can tell you what you want to know, king. The implication of that statement is that these soothsayers, diviners, had no line of communication with the gods. They're admitting, we don't really have any special knowledge at all, king. We can go read our books in the library, but if you want a message from the gods, you're going to have to talk to someone else, because we can't help you. They had no way of knowing the unknowable. And so verses 2 through 9 reveal the incompetence of the wise men. 2 through 11 reveal the incompetence of the wise men. Verses 12 and 13 reveal the king's indignation. Verse 12, because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was not a man to do things by halves. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill him. They're just going to round them all up, and there's going to be a great public execution. Now, such an act certainly fits within the pale of the brutality of most ancient Near Eastern monarchs. This was kind of standard stuff. Daniel and his friends, well, they were just junior wise men, newly appointed, and so they weren't even at this meeting. But their arms and legs are going to be ripped off their bodies anyway. Guilt by association. However, in verses 14 through 19, there are four exchanges of information that changed the whole situation. And therefore, we'll call these verses information. Verse 14. They're out looking for Daniel and his friends. They're gathering up all the wise men so they can kind of, you know, take them and have a big public show, execute them. Verse 14. Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the men, wise men of Babylon. So Daniel wants to find out from this guy, get some information. If I'm going to have my arms ripped off, you could at least maybe tell me why. Daniel said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? Or perhaps brutal would be a better translation. Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. There's going to be an exchange of information. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation of the king, to the king. So Daniel first talks to Arioch, and then he goes and talks to the king. Information is being exchanged all the way around. Now, for whatever reason, primarily God's grace, Nebuchadnezzar seemed to believe that young Daniel could perhaps succeed where his superiors had failed. And so he gives him time. Whereas the other guys were just stalling, for some reason he believed Daniel actually maybe could do something. So having exchanged information with Arioch and the king, Daniel went home and did the same with his friends. This is the third exchange. Verse 17. Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter, in order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So the wise men of Babylon might consult their libraries to know the unknowable. Daniel consulted his God. Only Yahweh knew the unknowable. Only Yahweh could know the future. Daniel was not worried about dream manuals. He was not worried about incantations or magic. He went to his God. In verse 19 then, God gave Daniel the information. This is the fourth exchange of information. God gave Daniel the information that he needed to keep himself and the others alive. Verse 19. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Daniel blessed the God of heaven. God gave Daniel the information he needed, both the dream and the interpretation. Daniel's response to that in the following verses was praise. We're going to switch from I's to P's now. I ran out of I's. We're going to go to P's. Praise. That's the title of the next section, verses 20 through 23. Daniel gives praise in this section, and it points out to us the message of the whole chapter. First, God controls eras of history. Verse 21. Verse 20, Daniel answered and said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs." If you remember Nebuchadnezzar's dream, this is very fitting, right? God controls eras of history. He changes the times and epochs. Secondly, God dethrones and enthrones rulers. Verse 21 again. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men, knowledge to men of understanding. You see there that God dethrones and enthrones rulers. He removes and establishes kings. Third, at the end of verse 21, you can see there that God knows and can reveal the unknowable. Also a theme of this chapter. He gives wisdom to wise men, knowledge to men of understanding. Verse 22, it is he who reveals the profound and hidden things and knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power. Even now thou hast made known to me what we requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. To sum it up, God knows and controls the future. And if he wants, he can tell us about it. In this case, he did. Now, armed with the information that he needed, Daniel made a hurried appointment with the king. Kind of clear the schedule, just we need to see each other, king. Verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and he went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. Typical of political positioning, Arioch tries to take credit for finding Daniel, right? Hey, king, I found the guy. Remember, it's me, Arioch. I found him. Just in case you forgot, my name's Arioch. That's A-R-I-O-C-H. Typical. Daniel, however, drew no attention to himself. The difference is discernible. Before he gave the dream and the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel gave a little preamble, and that's our title for the next section, verses 24 through 30. A preamble or a preface before he had to do his performance for the king. The preamble runs from verse 24 through verse 30. It is an explanation that God got all the glory for Daniel's special knowledge, and Daniel got none. Arioch's out for fame. Daniel is after God's glory. Verse 26. And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered before the king and said, As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, nor conjurers, nor magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He is not merely the God of Israel. Daniel refers to him here as the God of heaven. He's God everywhere. There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days, in the time afterwards. This is your dream and the visions in your mind while you're on your bed. And then Daniel lets the suspense build a little bit longer because he doesn't tell him what the dream was. As for you, O king, while you were on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you should understand the thoughts of your mind. You might remember when Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dream in Genesis 41. Joseph said this, It is not in me, God will give you a favorable answer, O Pharaoh. Daniel is of exactly the same mind and humble heart. God gets all the glory. And that was the point of his preamble. He's making sure the king knows, King, I'm not anyone special. It's my God who is special. And so having established that in his preamble, Daniel moves to the prophecy. And that's really what this dream is. It's a dream given to Nebuchadnezzar by God that symbolizes things that were going to happen in the future. And so it's a prophecy, and that's what Daniel then does. He takes that, gives the dream to the king, gives its interpretation, but it is all a prophecy. A God-given prophecy regarding the future. Verse 31. Now he actually gets to the dream. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. You can see why the dream needs some interpretation, because at this point, you don't have a clue, and neither does anyone else, what in the world the dream is about. What Nebuchadnezzar had seen was a giant, gleaming, awesome statue. It was glorious in its splendor. But as Nebuchadnezzar watched, that statue was hit on the feet by a missile, a block of masonry, carved stone. Not one carved by human hands, though. And then, when that stone hit the feet, the whole statue just exploded, just blew up into a billion tiny shards. It was crushed to dust. Now, by this point, Nebuchadnezzar must have been absolutely entranced, don't you think? I would love to have been there in the throne room that day just to watch the play of expression on his face. Wouldn't it have been fun? He'd given his wise men an impossible task, and they had failed in their incompetence. But here was this humble Jewish boy, to be honest, telling him exactly what he had seen in his dream. And Daniel must have gotten it right, because Nebuchadnezzar let him continue with the interpretation, right? The interpretation of the prophecy. Now, the statue had consisted of four sections, each made up of different materials. Each section represented a different kingdom. It started with Nebuchadnezzar, the golden head. Daniel heads into the interpretation in verse 36. This was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven, notice who's in charge here, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he's given them into your hand. And he's caused you to rule over all of them. You are the heads of gold. The second kingdom, Daniel says, as he continues in the text, is represented by the chest and the arms of silver, the third by the belly and the thighs of bronze, verse 39. And after you, speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar, after you there will arise another kingdom, inferior to you, and then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. That's the second and the third kingdoms. The fourth kingdom was represented by the legs and the feet. It would be a powerful, crushing kingdom. But it would have, said Daniel, a strange weakness, represented by the fact that the feet and the toes were an unlikely combination of iron and potter's clay. Verse 40. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all other things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. And in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. And as the toes and the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. That's going to be intermarriage some way, the various parts of peoples of the kingdom. But they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Now, what in the world is the meaning, right? Various suggestions have been given regarding what this statue actually represented. Daniel says it represented a series of four kingdoms, of which Nebuchadnezzar was the first. Well, various suggestions have been given. Some say it represented not world history, but only Babylonian history. That is, the dynasty of Nebuchadnezzar, the kings who followed immediately after him in Babylon. Now, the problem with that view is that including Nebuchadnezzar, there were five kings in the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, not four, and so you've got a problem there. And the characteristics of those kings and what is mentioned here simply don't match up. The last kingdom of Babylon was not a crushing kingdom at all. In fact, it was a kingdom that was being crushed. So it doesn't match up. Some liberals suggest that this dream refers to four Assyrian kings. But the dream is said to refer to the future and to Nebuchadnezzar as the start of the line of kingdoms. So that clearly doesn't work. So I would suggest to you then that the best option then is that this refers to four kingdoms, four world empires. Verse 39 tells us that they will rule over all the earth. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian empire is first in Daniel's interpretation. It is glorious, it is powerful, it is golden. The second empire following in world history would be the Medes and the Persians. They were considered as one kingdom in chapter 8, verse 20, and should be here as well. That empire encompassed more territory than Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, but is called inferior in verse 39, probably because it didn't have nearly the unity or focused power that Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom had. The third kingdom, that of bronze, which ruled over all the earth, would be a fitting description of Alexander the Great's far-flung Greek empire. He took his conquering army beyond the ends of the earth, as it was known in his day. The fourth empire of iron, then, would be Rome, and certainly iron would be a very fitting description of Rome, which crushed and gobbled up every other kingdom it encountered. Verse 40. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. Rome, with inexorable power, ate up and dominated the area, the previous three kingdoms, and to be honest, an area far beyond those kingdoms. It was a massive and powerful empire. In the east, Rome's rule lasted 1,000 years. But as verse 41 notes, it was a divided kingdom. Daniel knows his history well, even if he's writing it in advance. Rome was a divided kingdom, part of it strong, part of it weak, clay and iron together. Now, make a point here that I think we need to keep in mind. Some would make much of some of the other details of the statue. The silver part had two arms, and that, they said, refer to the joint kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Greek soldiers sometimes carried bronze shields, and that assures us that the third kingdom is Greece. The iron part of the statue had two legs, and that refers then to the east and the west divisions of the Roman Empire. Now, all those things may be true, but can I suggest that caution is advisable in interpreting the parts of the dream that Daniel didn't? For example, some make much of the two legs. I don't know how many other legs a statue of a man would have other than two, but they make much of the two legs and say that must refer to the divided kingdom of Rome, the Roman Empire. The problem with that, as logical as it sounds, is that the division of the empire was not represented by the two legs at all. In the text, it's represented by the clay and the iron and the feet, not the two legs, verse 41. And in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. The legs had nothing to do with division, east and west in the Roman Empire. The division in the empire that Daniel referred to is represented by the toes of clay and iron. The fact that the statue had two legs is given absolutely no significance at all by Daniel, and I think then we need to be careful of trying to build a whole significance around that. I point that out to you just to help you avoid interpreting more than Daniel did. And that's not exegesis, it's guessing, and we need to acknowledge it as that. Now, that aside, having surveyed the statue, in the final section of his interpretation, having given you a picture of world history and the kingdoms that were coming, Nebuchadnezzar and the three world kingdoms that would follow after him, having given you that basic overview, world history 101, Daniel comes to the real point of the whole dream. Now, let's first review that part of the dream, verse 34 again. You continued looking, Nebuchadnezzar, until a stone was cut out without hands. And it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay, and it crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone struck the statue, that struck the statue became a great mountain, and it filled the whole earth. Now, in verses 44 and 45, Daniel gave the interpretation. Verse 44. And in the days of those kings, the kings of the last empire that he's just mentioned, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. Do you remember Daniel's prayer, his praise earlier? It is God who takes down rulers and who establishes rulers. In the end of the days of those, or in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left to another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. According to Daniel's song of praise in verses 20 through 23, God changes the times and the epochs and removes and establishes kings. Well, in the days of the kings of the fourth empire, God, it says, will rise from his throne and he will do just that. Unlike the other four kingdoms, though, God's kingdom won't be destroyed, it won't be replaced, it won't be conquered by another people. In fact, having crushed all human empires, God's empire will endure forever. Again, verse 44. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put to an end all of these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. God's kingdom will destroy all other human kingdom, all human kingdoms, and it will endure eternally. God's victory is not a human act, it is a divine act. No human hand excavated or carved the stone that shattered the statue. It said that in verses 34 and 35. There was no human contribution to the destroying of the human kingdoms. It is a divine act, solely and completely. Human hands did not carve out that stone. And the stone zeroed in on the statue's feet, the last portion of the Fourth Empire's reign, and crushed them. And it says, then the stone filled the whole earth, became a mountain that filled the whole earth. The terminology mountain is used a number of times in the Old Testament. You can write down Isaiah 2, verse 1 and following, where mountain is used to represent a kingdom. And so what that, I think, is obviously saying is God's kingdom, the stone, crushes the statue and then becomes the mountain that fills the whole earth. God's kingdom dominates the universe. So the stone zeroed in on the statue's feet. The last portion of the Fourth Empire's reign crushed it. And that caused the whole statue to disintegrate. The whole of human history, the whole of human power and human kingdoms, all of history, all that they brought together, all that they contributed, all of that is absolutely annihilated in an instant of time. God will pulverize the Fourth Empire and establish His own. You have to see the statue exploding, just blowing up, absolutely destroyed. That's the picture. Daniel gave us the interpretation, verse 45, inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, it crushed the iron, the bronze, silver, gold, all that. The great God has made known to the king what's going to take place in the future. God's kingdom will replace all human kingdoms. Now, here's the question. All of that you probably could have read and come up with yourself. You're intelligent. What does this refer to? This is really the theological question behind it. What does this refer to? What is the event where all human kingdoms are destroyed and God's kingdom is established? This is the debated part of this passage. And so let me give you some explanation on that. Again, several suggestions have been made. What is this referring to? Some focus on the words that begin verse 44. Look there. In the days of those kings. They focus on that and they say, well, this event must take place during the time of the Roman Empire, the historical Roman Empire, the New Testament era. In the days of those kings, human empires will be shattered and destroyed. They would take that then. They'd say, okay, well, what events during the days of the Roman Empire would do that? And the one they logically would point to would be the cross of Christ. They would say, this is the event by which God established His kingdom. Now, while I would certainly agree that the cross is primary in the establishing of God's kingdom, there's no question of that, I must also say that I can't accept that Christ's death and resurrection is that to which this prophecy was pointing. The simple fact is that Christ's death doesn't fit what Daniel says. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the world's empires were hit by a stone missile, shattered and swept away in a catastrophic event, blown away like chaff. The statue explodes. I would be hard-pressed to say how it is that Christ's death on the cross shattered the Roman Empire and all human kingdoms. I just can't explain that. The Roman Empire and its historical form lasted at least 1,000 years after Christ's death. That's hardly a catastrophic explosion. The human kingdoms beyond that time have continued for another 1,000 years after that to our day. And if God's kingdom is the church, as this view would be suggesting then, the picture is thoroughly confused. Daniel said the start of God's kingdom erased all others. That was critical to understand. God will set up a kingdom, and His kingdom erases all others. It annihilates them. The human kingdoms are destroyed in an instant, and God's kingdom replaces it, fills the whole earth. So Daniel said that the start of God's kingdom erased all others. But the start of the church 2,000 years ago certainly didn't erase human kingdoms. They're still around, right? Daniel does not picture God's kingdom and the human kingdoms continuing side by side, as would be necessary if he were picturing the church. In Daniel's view, God's kingdom is established when the others are dramatically and catastrophically destroyed. Now, It seems much better to me then to see that the events Daniel is referring to here in verse 44 and 45 are the day of the Lord and the return of Christ. That is the catastrophic event in which the kingdoms of the world are annihilated in a moment of time and replaced by God's kingdom. Now, that view, however, seems to stumble on the phrase that begins verse 44. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up the kingdom. Oh, the days of which kings? Well, the last kings of the kingdom of iron, the fourth world empire. Now, how do we reconcile this? Here's what I would suggest. The fourth empire of iron and clay was Rome. In our review of world history, we've seen that. Start with Nebuchadnezzar, you go to the Persian Empire, go to Greece, Rome is the fourth. And it is fittingly described as a crushing iron empire with strange sort of weaknesses. Now, here's the point, though. In the interpretation that Daniel was given, Daniel saw that last empire not ending at a point in history. He saw that stretching all the way to the end of the age before it ended. And that's how he could say, in the days of those kings, not the historical kings of the Roman Empire as we know it, but in the days of those kings, who will be emperors, over that last world empire at the end of the age. And therefore, he's referring to the day of the Lord when they are destroyed. And so I would suggest that the kings referred to are not Roman Empire emperors of history. They are men yet to come. Now, let me tell you why I believe we can suggest that. I would suggest that to you because the very same thing that I am outlining here, Daniel jumping over a great period of history and looking at the fourth kingdom as spanning that whole period all the way to the end of the age, the very same thing happens in Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel goes into much more detail. And as we saw in our review of the structure of this book, Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 parallel each other. They're both visions about four world empires. Turn for a moment to Daniel 7 and you'll see what I'm talking about. I don't want to get into an exposition of this chapter yet. It will take much longer than our exposition of chapter 2 because it's far more detailed. But let me just read a few verses for you to show you that Daniel sees four world empires and he sees the last one stretching all the way to the end of the age. Verse 23 of Daniel 7. Thus he said, "The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom." An angel is interpreting the dream for Daniel, the vision. "The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it." So it's the fourth kingdom of Daniel 2, right? "As for the ten horns," he's talking about some of the details of the vision now, "out of this kingdom ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them." It may be that this relates to what you would presume would be ten toes at the bottom of the feet of the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, but chapter 2 doesn't tell you whether there are ten toes or 20, and so we need to be a little careful with that, but that could be. "As for the ten horns, out of the kingdoms ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and he'll subdue three of the kings. He will speak out against the Most High, and he will wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and the law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times and a half a times, three and a half times, probably 3.5 years. But there's going to be this last great king of this last great empire, and he is going to be an awful king. He is going to wear down," a term, military term used of attacking and destroying your enemies. "He's going to wear down the saints of the Highest One." That's persecution. "But," verse 26, "the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever." Sounds a lot like a stone smashing a statue, doesn't it? "Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole of heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions will serve and obey him." God's kingdom will be a great mountain that will fill the whole earth. Now, come back to Daniel 2. I think the parallels are obvious, too obvious to be ignored. Daniel looked in chapter 7 at the last great world empire and said it bridges all the way to the end of the age when God destroys all kingdoms completely and fills the earth, the universe, with his kingdom. Now, what Daniel does there in Daniel 7 is typical of biblical prophecy. It touches only on the mountain peaks. He looks at the Roman Empire and then he jumps all the way to the end of the age. That happens all the time in biblical prophecy. 1,000 years might be skipped when only the highlights are given. I believe that that is exactly the case in Daniel 2 as well. Daniel can say that God will set up his kingdom in the days of those kings because he sees that fourth kingdom not just as historical Rome, but he sees it as stretching all the way to the end of the age. That's what happens in Daniel 7, and I believe it is the same here. There might be further evidence for that in chapter 9. Think of this for a moment. Oh, turn there. I wasn't going to do this, but it's too good. You can't miss it. Look at Daniel chapter 9. Verse 25, it says there that the Messiah, the Prince, will come at a certain point in history. And Daniel's given all kinds of weeks and numbers, and it refers to years and all of that. We'll cover that. But notice something in verse 26. Then after the 62 weeks, at the end of a certain period of time, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. I think we can track with that. We understand. We're looking back on history. We have Isaiah 53 as well. Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Jesus died, right? Well, there's going to be an event after that as well. Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That means Jerusalem and the temple, right? Now, who in the world is this prince who is to come? And who are his people? Verse 27 will give us a clue. He, and the reference is the prince who is to come, not Messiah, he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week with Israel. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and the grain offering, and on the wing of abominations, you know it's not the Messiah, right? Because he doesn't abominate. It's got to be the prince who is to come. On the wing of abominations will come, and he will make desolate, even a complete destruction. Somebody's going to come into the temple and he's going to make an absolute abomination in the temple. Well, we know who this guy is. Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He is the man of lawlessness. He is the Antichrist. So, there is a prince of who is to come. His people. That prince of verse 26 is Antichrist. He is the prince who is yet to come. Notice, though, it's not he who destroys the temple and the city following Messiah's death. It is the people of the prince who is to come who will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, okay, history exam. Who was it that in 70 AD destroyed Jerusalem and the temple? That's right, the Romans. Somehow Daniel looks at the Antichrist and says he will have a connection with the people who destroyed the temple and the city of Jerusalem following Messiah's death. And that was the Romans. And so I don't think I'm grasping here when I suggest to you that Daniel sees the last world empire stretching all the way to the end of the age. It is the Roman Empire, but it stretches all the way to the end. And its last king, he says very specifically, will have a connection, whatever it is, with Rome. And so I don't think I'm grasping when I suggest to you then that Daniel says, in the days of those kings, he's referring not to the historic Roman Empire, emperors, as we would look at them looking back. He is referring to the kings at the end of the age who will somehow still represent Rome. So, where was I? The Antichrist, the last world ruler, is said to have connection with ancient Rome. And so the crushing of human kingdoms can't refer to Christ's death during the Roman era because there's no connection between the prophecy and what actually happened. Human kingdoms are still hanging around. It can't be the church. That can't be God's kingdom, as talked about in Daniel 2, because its beginning didn't wipe out all the human kingdoms as Daniel 2 required. And therefore, I think the view I'm suggesting to you is the best view. Daniel sees the Roman Empire stretching somehow all the way to the end of the age. And the kings of that last empire in that last day, they will be the ones who will be annihilated by God and God's kingdom established. So, Daniel finishes the prophecy in verse 45. He's given Nebuchadnezzar the dream, and he's given him the interpretation. And the fact that he could only receive the dream by means of supernatural revelation, guarantees the interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar falls flat on his face, verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods, and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect of all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was still at the king's court. You can call this final section promotion. Promotion. Nebuchadnezzar fell down in front of Daniel, spouting praise for Daniel's gods. He's thrilled. His kingdom is the head of gold, and so his vanity is satisfied. Nebuchadnezzar's worried about his future. He knows now for sure. I mean, he's only in the second year of his reign right now, right? But he knows now for sure if the God of heaven, whoever that is, he doesn't really know, but if this God who can tell mysteries and reveal the future and know the unknowable, if that God says that he is going to be the head of gold, then Nebuchadnezzar looks at it and says, I must be going to have a great reign. I must be going to have a great kingdom and a great dynasty. And so Nebuchadnezzar's quite happy. He's not worried about the future. He maybe should worry about the stone that crushes all earthly kingdoms and obliterates and annihilates them, but he's not smart enough quite to get that point yet. And so he's not worried at all about the future. He knows he's going to be grand and glorious. He's happy. His praise acknowledged Daniel's God, but it was certainly not submission to Daniel's God. As any pagan would, he just adds one more god to his pantheon. That's what polytheists did. So, the immediate result of Daniel's success was promotion. To be governor of the province of Babylon, certainly a significant turn of events. And he was also appointed the chief administrator of the very happy to still be alive wise men. Daniel's promotion at his request was also accompanied by the appointment of his three friends as his assistants. Assuming they're cut from the same cloth as Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar is quite happy to oblige. And so, we come to the end of the chapter and ask, what's the point? God certainly didn't give Nebuchadnezzar this dream just to stroke Nebuchadnezzar's vanity. You're the golden head. You're a great and wonderful guy, Nebuchadnezzar. Now you can sleep peacefully at night. No, that's not the message. I think this dream and its interpretation had two purposes. Let me give them to you. Two purposes. The first was preparation. Preparation. This chapter served as a basic prophetic overview of world history. It's World History 101. It's a simple outline of events that prepare you for the far more complex visions that Daniel would receive 40 or 50 years later in chapters 7 and following. And so this dream is preparation for that, telling us about the four world empires and how God in the end will destroy the last one. This dream is preparation in another way as well. It is preparation for Nebuchadnezzar. It's a fascinating point. In chapter 4, you remember, Nebuchadnezzar will get another dream, a second dream from God. That dream, I believe, leads to Nebuchadnezzar's conversion. God sets him up with the first one. Nebuchadnezzar didn't get the message. And so God says, I'm going to give you a second one, Nebuchadnezzar, that you won't be able to ignore. And so the preparation of chapter 2 will lead to the transformation in chapter 4. I think we'll see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. I can't wait to talk to him. Preparation is the first purpose of this dream. Prepares you for the dream or the visions and prophecies to come at the end of the book. It also prepares Nebuchadnezzar for the dream of chapter 4. Besides preparation, though, the events of chapter 2 also gave instruction. Instruction. Not about which kingdom follows the next and all of that. It gives you instruction about God. About God. To be honest, we can look back at history, read about Babylon and Persia and Greece, and Rome. Daniel's instruction is not all that detailed in this chapter. But what he teaches us about God is of absolute consequence. You see, we still live in an age when people want to know the future. You do, and I sinfully do as well. That's why we worry. We pursue all kinds of weird and wacky things to find it out. We'll sin with anxiety and worry because we want to know the future. Now, some are more scientific than others in their pursuit of knowing the future or what will come to pass. Some study past trends and try to predict then what will happen. Others pursue sheer mysticism, liver gazing or its modern equivalent. It is God, however, who changes times and epochs, who removes and establishes kings. Like Daniel and his three friends, our trust must not be in research or mysticism when it comes to the future. Our trust must be in God, the God who knows and controls the future. Daniel and his friends rejected all of the mysticism and the hocus pocus, all of the research and learning of their Babylonian overlords. And when push came to shove, they said, "We will go to God's, and we will trust that either He will reveal or it is not important for us to know." Our trust must not be in the things of the world when it comes to what will happen tomorrow, what will happen next week, or what will happen next month. It must not be in our knowledge. It must not be in what we can try to generate. Our trust is in our God. And He is, in fact, according to Daniel, already written the conclusion of world history and everything in between now and that conclusion. Daniel gave us the outline, World History 101. And you know what? If God can give us the outline of world history, then I think He knows what's going on in our life as well. And therefore, God is our trust. He is our trust for eternity and all the great events of all the ages. And He is our trust for tomorrow when we get out of bed and face what the day brings. The lesson of Daniel chapter 2 is simple but profound. We must trust the God who knows and controls the future. Lord, we thank You that there is no one like You, not even one. No one who can compare to You. There is no method that can tell the future. There is no other God, small g, out there who can tell us. Only You know what will happen. You haven't always told us. You've told us some things, and we'll find those in the book of Daniel. You've told us of the great events at the end of the age and how there will be great, great persecution and how You will rescue those who are faithful to You. We know it's coming. We don't, however, necessarily know what will happen tomorrow or the day after that or the day after that. And yet, Lord, we know it's not important for us to know because You haven't told us. And like Daniel and his friends, we will not turn to human ways to try to manipulate or control the future. We will not turn to the sin of worry or anxiety. We will turn in prayerful trust to You, knowing that You are in control. And with a God that loves us as much as You do, we know He can trust You. Thank You for the lesson of this chapter. In Jesus' name, amen.